Hi, this is Pastor Chris, and welcome to Strength for Today from Living Hope Baptist Church in Geneva, New York. Today is Friday, April 24th, 2020. My first year of college was difficult. I moved across the country to a city I did not know. And in doing so, I had traded a comfortable suburban experience for a pretty harsh urban one. To further complicate matters, I didn't have a personal moral framework other than don't get caught and don't do anything you'll regret in the long term. And this framework, or lack of it, permitted me to engage in all sorts of self-destructive activities, like, you know, the late-night partying, the drinking, the drugs, and skipping classes. So as the year drew to a close, I found myself strung out and worn out, knowing something was really wrong with me and wrong with the way I was approaching life. The third floor of the music conservatory I was attending was reserved for the teacher's studios, and as I would wait for my weekly violin lesson to start, I would wander the halls there looking at the doors. The building itself was one of those ugly cinder block affairs, very industrial and impersonal, and the walls were always bare. There were no bulletin boards or posters or anything, just bare. But the doors were covered with papers. For the teacher, I guess it was like the 80s version of a Pinterest page. And they would tape up cartoons and quotes and announcements of upcoming concerts. So as I said, it was late in the school year, an afternoon in mid-spring, that I found myself wandering the third floor reading doors. And then I came to the door in the northwest corner. This door was littered with quotes and cartoons, and I spent several minutes reading, starting with the cartoons first, of course. I moved on then to the quotes, and starting with the ones with the big lettering and taped at eye level, and then gradually working my way around the edge and to the less noticeable quotes. And there, near the edge, over there by the hinges, was a blue 3x5 card, and I read it, and then I read it again. And the words burned their way into my memory, and this is what it said. The only reason for doing the right thing is that it is the right thing to do. Any other reason is a reason to do something else. I read it again. The only reason for doing the right thing is that it is the right thing to do. Any other reason is a reason to do something else. Aha! I thought. Here was the answer to my problems, to my depression, to my malaise, to my worn-out state, to which my intemperate lifestyle had brought me. I'd been doing the wrong things, as evidenced by wrong results. And I assumed if I now did the right things, I would get the right results. So I concluded I must determine now to do the right things. But then I saw I had yet another problem. Apart from being OCD and way, way too wrapped up in my own thoughts, I saw that doing the right things for the hope of physical or emotional gain would be doing them for a reason other than doing it solely because they were right. This is very confusing. No, I would have to choose, I thought, the right thing because it was right, not in the hope of gain. But then I'd be stuck. Of course, then I wondered why, if I did not hope to gain by choosing the right, or if I had no expectation whatsoever of gaining by choosing the right, why would I ever choose it? Such are the ruminations of a mentally ill freshman violinist, right? Anyways, I stood and I stared at that quote, and another question came to mind. How did I perceive or know the right? Was it even possible that my right might be in conflict with somebody else's right? Well, I pushed aside all those questions of definitions and decided I would just attempt to live by this piece of graffiti wisdom. Well, for the next hour or so, I guess I was successful in a way. My lesson went okay, and I did the things that felt right, letting my conscience be my guide. Thank you, Jiminy Cricket. And then suddenly, I came to an epistemological crisis. A girl. A really cute girl. My lesson had just finished. I put away my violin, I thanked my teacher, and I stepped out of his studio into the corridor. And as I did, I saw a young lady seated on a bench nearby. She had a book on her lap, and she was studying it, making notes with a pen in the margins. But this was not just any young lady. This was a lady I had admired from afar. In fact, just a week or so earlier, she had been the subject of conversation I had had with my stand partner. He and I had been seated on the stage in the big auditorium, dressed in our tuxedos, waiting to begin a performance with our symphony orchestra. We'd tuned, we'd warmed up, and now we were killing time until the conductor came out and the concert started. I think it was the other guy who started the conversation. He said, "Are you dating someone?" He was one of those upperclassmen who was already married, and I had a feeling his wife might have been trying to set me up or something. Nah, I answered. I haven't met anyone yet. I didn't add the obvious, who wants to date me. But he looked around the orchestra and the audience. Who would you date here, if you could? He asked. Okay, so I scanned the orchestra, and then I turned and I looked out at the audience. I had a good view of the audience. I seated right there on the edge of the stage. It was a big audience, probably about 1,000 people or so. So I looked and I looked and I looked, and then about 10 rows up and to the right, I saw this girl. How could I have missed her? She was the prettiest girl there, I thought. So subtly, with my bow, I kind of pointed that direction, and I said to my stand partner, her. I would date her. And now, coincidence of coincidences, coming out of my violin lesson into that deserted hall, here's that girl. I run right into her, that same girl. And she looked up as I came out, and I nodded at her, and she nodded at me, and then I walked on past her. Well, I'd almost reached the staircase at the end of the corridor when I heard her voice behind me. She said, "You goof! Didn't you see me there? I was waiting for you. Why else would I be sitting up here on the third floor?" Okay, this was the moment of testing for my new moral compass. I mentally pulled out that blue 3x5 card and I reread it. The only reason for doing the right thing is that it is the right thing to do. Any other reason is a reason to do something else. But wait, suddenly I experienced inner turmoil. Things in my brain were whizzing around like one of those contraptions in the cartoons right before they explode. What, here in this situation, was right? What did my inner sense of right tell me? There are many voices in our head. No, I don't mean the ones psychotic people hear. I mean the voices of mentors, of parents, younger selves, older selves, and friends, of better selves that want physical and emotional health, and of course of your sensual self that wants comfort and pleasure. So the internal argument began. You don't have time to get involved with a girl. That's not why you're at conservatory. You're there to play the violin. Do the right thing and keep walking. I think that was my mother's voice. And, look, a nice girl isn't that forward. It's just not right. Again, I think that was my mom's voice. And, woohoo, a girl! That I think pretty sure was my 13-year-old self. Then, it's okay to date in moderation, but don't let it interfere with your studies. That would be the right way to handle it. I think that was my dad's voice. And then, go for it. Pretty girl, college is about enjoying yourself and being independent. That's what's right. I think that was the voice of my friends. I think that is probably the point at which the contraption in my brain exploded. I'm not sure what other damage that explosion wrought, but one thing it did for sure was destroy that 3x5 card with the clever quote. I saw it was useless. No one knew the right thing. There was no right thing. There was only better and worse. We're all floating specks on the surface of an ocean of relativism. The quote was mere semantics and nothing more. The only guide, I decided, was to do what you want in the moment and let the chips fall where they would. In an oddly related yet unrelated conversation around this time, another violinist, a friend of mine, sort of summarized the conclusion to which I had arrived. He was, I don't know why, for some reason, going on about war and about the draft and that sort of stuff. And he said, some people, for some reason, think it's cool to die for their country. I don't get that. What's in that for me? It just gets you dead. Me? I'd rather live on my knees than die on my feet. And I remember hearing that and thinking, yeah, that's right. There is nothing absolute, nothing right. So there's nothing worth dying for, maybe even nothing worth suffering for. With all of this, Jesus disagreed. With all of this. And this disagreement is seen clearly in one short statement in the Sermon on the Mount, when he said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." But let's go back. Notice that Jesus spoke specifically of righteousness, that is, the quality of rightness. He did not dismiss it as unreal or unknowable. He asserts rather that it is both real and knowable. But how is this possible? It is possible, I would suggest, because the standard of righteousness or right exists externally to man. It is possible because there is a God, a true God who is transcendent. and who is, with absolute consistency and immutability, the eternal standard of righteousness. Jesus himself did not debate the existence of God with his listeners. He did not need to. They generally accepted God's existence and revelatory nature. These were the folks who had received the promises of God and the law through Moses. They believed this. They were not lost in the sea of postmodern relativism, as so many around us today are. That said, they still struggled with this question of righteousness. And to them, Jesus affirms them in their presupposition that a righteousness of God exists. His difference with them is when he differs on how that righteousness can be realized. To these folks, Jesus comes, declaring himself ultimately to be the righteousness of God displayed and given sacrificially, that they might know and experience, realize that righteousness. And notice this, Jesus considers this righteousness, this rightness, worth suffering for. So this rightness can be known, and once it is known, it is worth suffering for. But what does suffering or persecution mean in this context? Well, it means denying one's own comfort in the moment by clinging to a truth and bearing whatever negative consequence may come as a result. It means delaying one's gratification, delaying comfort for the sake of that which one knows is right. And we have maintained that the right is that which conforms to God's perfectly righteous character. So, clinging to God, clinging to his perfect words, regardless of inner voices, internal conflict, confusion, or discomfort, that is what it means to suffer for righteousness' sake. But there is still more. You and I, we live in a sin-cursed world. We carry within ourselves a fleshly tendency to rebel against God. And the world is currently under the sway of the god of this age, that serpent of old, Satan. And so we find ourselves flung into a war, a battle which is raging around us, magnifying the temptations to flee righteousness and pursue earthly comfort. We find that standing for righteousness, standing for God and his word, incurs persecution, even as the one whom we followed received persecution, beatings, and death. The quote was wrong. The voices were wrong. My friend was wrong. But I really didn't see that until I became a Christian. The day I became a Christian, that 3x5 card reformed in my mind, but the writing changed. It now said this: the reason for doing the right thing is that it conforms to God's character. Anything else is sin. And to that was added this: and now you, Chris, can choose the right because Jesus Christ, the righteousness of God, died for you. The voices were wrong too. What mattered most wasn't, first of all, as they said, my self-interests. What mattered most was the glory of God, his rightness and obedience. Yes, ultimately, obedience is in my best interests, but that is secondary. Obedience to the holy, righteous God is right, regardless of the consequences. And my friend was wrong. There are things worse than physical death, and the big one, the worst of all, is separation from God. In short, it is better to die for and with God than to live without him. This beatitude addresses our loyalty. Will we stand with God? Will we stand for Jesus Christ, no matter what the outcome is? The promise here is that for those who do stand for Jesus Christ, they will find that they have made the right choice. They will inherit the kingdom of heaven. How will you make your decisions today? How will you determine what is right? How will you know if you are pursuing righteousness? Those are good questions. Fortunately, there is an answer. Proverbs 3:5-7 gives it. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. And how do you do that? Well, by meditating on his word day and night, and setting it always before you. That is why the psalmist can confidently say, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. And, as he says, because I keep your precepts, I have restrained my feet from every evil way that I may keep your word. The bottom line, the answer is in God's revealed word, the Bible. You, because of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, and because of the regeneration and illumination of the Holy Spirit, can know who he is, that he is the utterly right one. And when you know him, you will know that he is indeed worthy of your undivided, unswerving loyalty, even in the face of persecution. Well, for me, life has been a lot more simple since I came to Jesus. I am no longer being tossed about in a sea of relativism. I know what is right, because I know who is right. And that is why I can say today with confidence, the best is yet to come. I hope that's true for you as well today. God bless.